steal anything from the people. You have to pay for anything you're going to take. You have to give back anything you're going to borrow. You have to be courteous. You have to help the people. And so at the level of sort of basic behavior, they were profoundly different from most armies in China, which carried out a great deal of looting and abuse towards ordinary people. And this was increasingly true of the white armies in China in the 1920s and 30s. So they gained support on that basis. But more importantly, when they took over a piece of territory, they were able to – they were very, very concerned with consolidating you know, their support from the people in that territory. So they would carry out land reform,
mm-hmm.
and they would end taxation, probably the two single most important factors in solidifying this popular support, because Chinese peasants were obscenely overtaxed. And because the need for land was just crying out. There had been a massive famine in northern China in the late 1920s and early 1930s, which Edgar Snow, as you know, as a younger journalist, actually witnessed. And he talks about people starving to death while, you know, grain was piled up in the storehouses of the rich. And that's because land all throughout China was controlled by this tiny landowning class. Even if in some places small areas of land were actually redistributed, the fact that sort of this vast class of landless or near landless peasants were able to get for the first time enough land to support themselves, because that was the basic communist position. They weren't redistributing land wholesale at this point in the 1930s. What they were doing was creating a situation where every family had what was considered to be enough land to support itself. In the context of rural Chinese society, the way it had been before, that was an extraordinary gain for the masses of the people, mm-hmm. as was the end of this extortionate taxation. So those were probably the two most important things. And there were other measures that were carried out. The consumption of opium was banned.
Right.
Opium, of course, was an absolute scourge in Chinese society and had been for a century since the British had started smuggling it in, and it forced the Chinese state at gunpoint to accept that in the Opium Wars. And it has just ravaged Chinese society ever since. But the Reds banned it, and they banned foot binding and infanticide, which of girls was very, very common. And they took measures. They didn't have any resources. This is absolutely a shoestring government, a shoestring army. But they began to work towards universal primary education in the areas where they controlled, even in the 1930s. But resources were far too limited for sort of anything too substantial on those grounds. But even in the situation that they were in, where they had no resources and they were constantly under attack, they started trying to implement these basic reformist measures to improve the lives of the people. And they very, very quickly gained an extremely fierce allegiance, a very strong allegiance from the masses of the people in Soviet territory. A number of Red Army commanders told Snow about incidents where they had been they'd been blockaded, they'd been trapped in a particular area by a white army sometime in the late 1920s or in the 1930s. And the local people, even though they were poor, even though they had nothing, brought them their food. There was an incident that one commander talked about where the local peasants had brought them grain that they had hidden from the Kuomintang, and they lived on potatoes and roots for the winter because they wanted these soldiers to survive. And they were able to break through the blockade, and they were able to win. Edgar Snow went into a political education session in a Red Army unit. And he was a bit skeptical of some of the political rhetoric that was being thrown around in this this education session, and people were talking about how, you know, the people were absolutely behind them, the peasants love us. And he asked, Well, how do you know? And in answer to that question, 17 soldiers got up one after another and told him a story, an anecdote from their own experiences, where in the course of the wars that they'd been fighting, the local people somewhere or other had demonstrated the support for them, whether that meant providing them with food, whether that meant in one case taking in injured soldiers who had to be left behind of a long march and hiding them from the Kuomintang when the Kuomintang came into their village. or whatever it happened to be, but 17 people out of a class of 60 sitting in this room could produce a story, or more people could have. The meeting got cut short. They'd gone over time.
Right.
So the discussion had to be cut short because too many people had something to say in response to his question of, well, how do you know the people really support you? So Snow was just overwhelmed by the evidence that the masses of people in the Soviet area of China and wherever the communists were operating, in fact, supported them.
Well, yeah, and this is obviously huge because, of course, they're under continuous military pressure from the Kuomintang, you know, by the white armies, who, of course, have been trying to destroy them even while the Japanese are invading.
Yeah.
You know, and, of course, that poses a new threat. So maybe you could talk a bit about, like, the Long March, really how it came about and what took place and how this relates to the support of the people. Because, of course, as you just brought up, like, on the Long March itself, you can see, like, this is how where the support of the people really kind of comes into play in a really big way.
Yeah. So the basic circumstances that brought the Long March into being were sort of, I guess, the following. So from 1930 onward, Chiang Kai-shek's government launched a series of what were known as annihilation offensives against the Chinese Soviet Republic. And these offensives, one after the other, involved more and more soldiers. I think there were probably 200,000 involved in the first. And by the time you get to the last one, there's, you know, a couple of million, at least nominally involved. And all of these offensives failed, even though the numbers and the equipment of the white armies were vastly superior to the Red Army. And they failed for the basic, you know, political reason that the communists had higher morale because they knew that they were fighting for liberation and because they had the support of the people. But Chiang Kai-shek was smart enough by 1935 to realize that these offenses had failed. So they turned to a new strategy. They turned to a strategy of encircling the Soviet area, and they constructed a network of military fortifications all around the Chinese Soviet Republic, and they were able to essentially besiege the entire territory, and to the point where, you know, supplies and food were running low. And a decision was made by the communist leadership that a strategic retreat to sort of the other base, another base area that had been established in the northwest, was necessary. But it was no easy feat, of course, getting to that base area. And what had to happen was a march that took a year, an entire year, over what Snow helpfully points out was an area twice the length of a long march, Snow points out, was twice the width of the North American continent. It was 6,000 miles. North America is about 3,000 miles long. And this territory included some of the highest and most difficult to pass mountains in China. It included deserts. It included all of the largest and most powerful and dangerous rivers in China. It included passing through the territory of indigenous people who would basically attack any Chinese person who came into their territory and more or less kill them on sight, nearly to the borders of Tibet. They didn't quite get into Tibet, but they went very, very far west. And for long periods of a long march, they had no food, they had no resources. People had to subsist on unripe wheat. Or whatever they could find, but yeah, ultimately the Long March was able to succeed. And of course, during this march, they weren't just being left alone; they were being attacked by the provincial army of every white-controlled province that they went through, and by Chiang Kai-shek's National Army again and again. And tens of thousands of people died on the Long March, including there are also a large number of civilians, of peasants and ordinary working people from sort of the southern Soviet area who were going to the northwest with them. Despite the adversity and the enormous losses that they endured on the Long March, they were able to survive because of the well because of the same factor that enabled them to survive the annihilation offensives in the earlier 1930s, which was the deep political conviction that united the Chinese Red Army and the Chinese Communist Party, the conviction that they were fighting for the liberation of the Chinese people, and this was something that had to be done, and that any adversity that they endured in the course of that task was simply what came with it, and that they had a responsibility to survive and to endure and to continue to struggle until until conditions improved and they were able to advance. So I think the success of a long march, given the sort of the extraordinary environmental obstacles especially, but also the military and political ones, the success of a long march is it's incredible, and it's an enormously powerful testament to the strength of the conviction of the Chinese communists.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the great epics of revolutionary history.
Absolutely.
Like, when you talk about the Long March, and, like, it really is, like, kind of an epic of gallantry in Chinese history as well. I mean, it's taught in school. It's, like, really celebrated even to this day in China. And, and people like, the leadership of the Communist Party obviously was on the Long March itself as well.
Yeah.
Like, like Deng Xiaoping, Mao Zedong, all of them were there. We're also survivors of the Long March. And, of course, like, I believe there are even, like, top leaders who did not make it.
That's
like
true.
In the Long March, you know, and like it was not like they also were undergoing these trials about like, you know, facing these kind of food shortages and attacks and you know, all the hardships that came with traveling over these, you know, incredibly difficult terrain.
Yeah.
You know, across like thousands and thousands of kilometers.
Yeah.
To get to this remote
even
area
Mao
in the
and the
west.
Top leaders walked most of the Long March.
Yeah. If you'll excuse me for a second, back in the USSR, is just going to be back after this short break, and we're going to do some more interviews with Brendan Campisi on Edgar Snow and Red Star over China. So please stay tuned. Okay, I'm just going to.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 in Guelph, Ontario.
Each year in Guelph, approximately 99 teen pregnancies occur between women aged 15 to 19. Since 1983, the YMCA-YWCA of Guelph has offered a free program that offers a safe, non-judgmental place where pregnant and parenting teen mothers and fathers can belong and grow as parents. This program provides support, information, and resources to pregnant and parenting teens between the ages of 14 and 21. Fathers can be 24 years of age or younger. TAPS is a free ongoing program meeting weekly on Mondays and Thursdays between 4 and 7 p.m. and is designed to provide information on topics including but not limited to child development, nutrition, managing stress, birth control, budgeting, healthy relationships, and behavior management. For more information on TAPS, please visit guelphy.org or contact Sarah Robb, Teenage Parents Program Coordinator, at 519-821-3900 or Sarah Robb, that's S-A-R-A-H-R-O-B-B, at guelphy.org.
Pour les francophones et francophiles de la région, CFRU diffuse l'éclipse. L'émission musicale française à tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h le matin. Si vous faites partie d'une groupe ou une organisation francophone locale qui veut se faire distinguer ou bien vous voulez contribuer à notre programme, s'il vous plaît, me contactez, Sandra Doucette, par courriel francophone@cfru.ca. Soyez à l'écoute tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h pour les annonces, les événements, d'actualité et bien sûr la bonne musique française.
Hi, I'm Handel, and I volunteer at CFRU because I love working with the people here, and I also love the feeling of contributing something meaningful to the world.
CFRU is always looking for new volunteers. No experience is necessary, and all the training is free. If you would like to get involved, email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Hi, my name is Jeff, and I love CFRU because it introduces me to all kinds of music I would otherwise not have heard. And there's a vending machine down the hall.
This is a song born in the struggle of the brave Chinese people. It begins, Chi Lai, arise, you who refuse to be bond slaves, and ends, Chen Jing, march on. Chi Lai, who you want so nul di run man, ba woman di xie rao zu chong woman xing di chang chong. 中华民族高粱最危险的时候每个人得冒着发出最好的好伤起来起来起来我们万众一心冒着敌人的炮火前进冒着敌人的炮火前进 Enjing, enjing, jing. Arise, you who refuse to be bond slaves. Let's stand up and fight for liberty and true democracy. All our world is facing the chains of the tyrant. Everyone who works for freedom is now crying. Arise, arise, arise. All of us with one heart, with the torch of freedom, march on, with the torch of freedom, march on, march on, march on and on. Chi Lai, who you want so nul di run man, ba wo men di xie rao zu chong wo men xing di chang chang. 中华民族到了最危险的时候, 每个人被迫着发出最好的好声, 起来, 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 我们万众一心, 冒着敌人的炮火, 前进, 冒着敌人的炮火, 前进, 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 进.
Okay, so that was a crucial song I had to play right there. That was Paul Robeson with the National Anthem of the People's Republic of China, the March of the Volunteers. And of course, when he talks about the volunteers, he's really talking about the people who volunteered in the Revolutionary War in China, right? So like the people we're talking about in the Long March and the people we talk about in the liberation struggle against the Kuomintang, against the Japanese, and these people who rose up and became part of the Red Army. Like, he's talking about these people, right? So, so we talk about like the Long March and like the kind of impact that had on Chinese history. Like, did he get into in Red Star Over China, like really the national liberation struggle against Japan at all? or like the kind of tactics, the guerrilla tactics that they use against the Japanese and guerrilla resistance against the Japanese invasion and what have you.
Yeah, there is some discussion of that. Of course, so the book was published in 1937.
Oh, hold on. Okay, so yeah, maybe we could start that again. Sorry about that. I didn't actually have his mic turned on. Very unprofessional of me. So
there is some discussion of that in Red Star Over China, but not as much as there would have been if it had been written a bit later, because when the book was published in 1937, sort of the full-scale war against the Japanese was only really beginning. But it is a very important sort of the question of the Japanese invasion and occupation of these large areas of China is one of the overarching political questions in the book, because that was sort of one of the main issues at that time between the communists and the Kuomintang, was who was really capable of dealing with this issue. And what had been seen from the early 1930s, when the Japanese annexed Manchuria in 1931, I believe, onward, was that the Kuomintang was more interested in fighting the communists than they were in fighting the Japanese. They were devoting more resources, they were devoting more men. And in the words of, there were some patriotic Kuomintang soldiers who complained, actually including a Kuomintang warlord who was sort of more devoted to fighting the Japanese than Chiang Kai-shek was. And they complained that every one of these annihilation offensives against the communists had been accompanied with the loss of a city or a province or a region to Japan.
Right.
There was a one-to-one relationship there. The more they fought the communists, the less they could fight the Japanese, and the more they lost to Japan. So that's what precipitated this this patriotic mobilization within the Kuomintang areas, within White China, in 1935-36, to pressure the government to take up the struggle against the Japanese. And there was, at that point already, a small but growing communist-led partisan sort of resistance to the Japanese occupation in northern China. And Edgar Snow actually talked to Mao about how they expected to be able to defeat the Japanese. And he sort of outlines their prospective strategy, more than a real strategy at that point, but it was a prospective strategy in any case, of beginning at the level of partisan warfare and guerrilla warfare, and eventually sort of escalating to the level of sort of conventional kind of positional warfare against Japan. And in the course of that struggle, Mao and the communist leadership were very, very adamant that they would be willing to unite with any patriotic force in China, and they would be willing to unite with any country in the world who wanted to fight Japanese imperialism. Even in 1936, Mao was arguing that the Japanese were going to start stepping on the toes of the Western countries who were invested in Eastern Asia, and they were going to start stepping on the toes of the United States, and that there was a basis for unity between those countries and the Chinese people as they fought Japan. Now, I think it's very possible that he played that up because he was talking to an American journalist, and this was a self-conscious and self-interested political message being sent, rather than any sort of illusions about the willingness of the Western countries to fight the fascist aggressive countries at that time. Because of course we all know what was going on in the broader international situation in the 1930s as far as that went. But they were in any case willing to unite with more or less any Chinese or international ally who would help them fight Japan. And one last thing I'll say about sort of the communist perspective on the anti-Japanese struggle at this point was that Mao made it very, very clear that they were not fighting the Japanese people. They were fighting the Japanese state and the Japanese ruling class, and that any Japanese prisoners, proletarian, conscripted Japanese soldiers who were captured by the communists were to be treated well, and they were to be appealed to switch sides and to fight against, their own oppressors in Japan. And Mao actually believed that the increasing strength of the liberation movement in China and the eventual victory of the liberation struggle in China would precipitate a revolution in Japan. So I found that that interesting, that the sort of the internationalism that came through in this national liberation struggle to be very striking.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's obviously that's very, very powerful, and ultimately it did carry the Red Army, the People's Liberation Army, as it became, to victory. In 1949, you saw the establishment of the People's Republic of China, and you know, really one of the most massive revolutionary victories of all time. You know, and it's worth pointing out, of course, it wasn't just. I mean, there were other volunteers who served with the Chinese forces in this war, from Korea and from other nations, and I believe there were even some Japanese soldiers who did, in fact, switch sides.
There were during the Second World War. Edgar Snow met, I believe, in China, Japanese resistance fighters who had switched sides and wanted to fight the Japanese government. So that did at least take place on some scale.
Something not a lot of people even know about. But I think, I mean, this interview has been absolutely amazing. Like, you know, it definitely sheds a lot of light on the actual, you know, the different tactics that the strategies that the communist forces in China employed, which ultimately carried them to victory, and the kind of organization that allowed them to withstand these kind of trials and these immense odds and still emerge victorious in the end. Because I think, as we've talked about before, virtually no one before Edgar Snow actually went to, travel with the Red Army. None of them thought that they would ultimately prevail and, establish government in China as they did in 1949.
He was definitely the very first person in Western public life to predict that the communists might win. And by 1944, the afterword of the edition of the book that I have is from 1944, he was predicting that they absolutely would win. They were unstoppable.
Yeah.
By that point.
It's true. I want to run this down, but I really want to hear your thoughts about this one final passage, which I'm going to read, which is by Kim San, who is a Korean volunteer with the Chinese Red Army, basically fighting alongside Mao's forces in the 1930s. And with the help of another American journalist who came to China around that time in 1937, he wrote the Song of Araran. And this is what he said from his own experience as a soldier fighting against the Japanese in China. "Nearly all the friends and comrades of my youth are dead. Hundreds of them. Nationalist, Christian, anarchist, terrorist, communist. But they are alive to me. Where their graves should be, no one ever cared. On the battlefields and execution grounds, on the streets of city and village, their warm revolutionary blood flowed proudly into the soil of Korea, Manchuria, Siberia, Japan, and China. They failed in the immediate thing, but history keeps a fine accounting. A man's name and his brief dream may be buried with his bones, but nothing that he has ever done or failed to do is lost in the final balance of forces. That is his immortality, his glory or shame. Not even he himself can change this objective fact, for he is history. Nothing can rob a man of his place in the movement of history. Nothing can grant him escape. His only individual decision is whether to move forward or backward, whether to fight or submit, whether to create value or destroy it, whether to be strong or weak." You know, I just wanted to maybe get your thoughts on that. Obviously, this isn't from Edgar Snow, but this is like from a contemporary combatant.
What I would say is that those words, with the appropriate changes, could have been written by most of the Chinese soldiers in the Red Army and most of the members of the Chinese Communist Party during this period. Mm-hmm. And, during his travels in the Soviet territory in China, Snow was always interested in talking to people about sort of the whole course of their lives and all of their experiences. And one of the recurring motifs that many of these communists, especially the older ones, brought up was that, similarly, most of the friends and comrades of their youth were dead. Because, of course, tens of thousands of communists had been slaughtered by the Kuomintang right, by the counter-revolutionaries in 1927-28, and then they had been driven into the countryside. And thousands of people had not survived sort of these years in the late 20s and early 30s when the communist movement barely survived in China. And thousands of people had been killed in the annihilation offensives and on the Long March. Many people had lost, you know, they'd lost their family members. Some people had, you know, they had a wife and children in urban eastern China they hadn't seen since 1928, since they were driven into the countryside. Mao, in the 1920s, was married to a woman who was executed by the Kuomintang in 1930. So that experience of sort of this enormous loss of comrades from their youth was definitely a common experience for the Chinese Communist movement during this period, but also that motivation that comes through in that piece, that motivation to continue, and the confidence that the movement of history was going forward, that the movement of history was on their side, was also something that was very, very deeply shared by the Chinese Communist movement at the same time.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to have to end it there, but thank you very much, Brendan, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
This was absolutely brilliant. So this is Brendan Campisi, and we were talking about the Red Tsar Over China by Edgar Snow, a very iconic book describing the progress of the Chinese Revolution in the 1930s. So the show's kind of winding down right now, but I'm going to play a few more other revolutionary songs. I'm going to end with the next song, The East Is Red. Very iconic song of the Chinese Revolution. And, of course, we're also going to play a clip from a member of Hands Off China in the UK. And he's going to talk about really what Mao Zedong and the Chinese Revolutionary struggle really meant, you know, in terms of China's development. And it's breaking out of poverty, breaking out of colonialism, breaking out of the suffering which had been imposed on it by imperialism. And I think that's going to wrap the show up. So anyway, stay with us, stay with Back in the USSR, and, you know, please stay tuned.
are saying, follow the example of Chairman Mao, engage in class struggle, and fight against imperialism, and that's the only way humanity can achieve liberation. I shall now call upon Comrade Carlos Ruhl, Secretary of the Hands of China, to speak to you now.
Okay, thank you very much. So, you know, I've got to point out, before I start giving a short speech, that giving such a speech, you know, a half-hour speech about Mao Zedong, is a relatively difficult job. The guy did quite a lot of living. You know, he was politically active for over half a century. Now, I know some of you may say, well, that's not very long. but to some of us, it's a really long time. And it was a very profound and a very significant half century. You know, he lived through the nationalist Chinese Revolution of 1911, led by Sun Yat-sen. He lived through the formation of the Chinese Communist Party in 1921. He was one of the very few people around that table. He lived through the Revolutionary Civil War, 1925 to 1927. The Second Revolutionary Civil War, 1927 to 1936. The War of Resistance against Japan. The War of Liberation. The birth of New China in 1949. It was Comrade Mao Zedong who, on the 1st of October 1949, pronounced the birth of the People's Republic of China. He led the construction of socialism. He lived through the Korean War, the industrialization of China, the modernization of China, the Sino-Soviet split, you know, the breakup of the previously relatively united world communist movement, the intense and sometimes deadly inter-party struggles within the Chinese Communist Party. So it was an incredibly momentous period of history, a story of never-ending struggle, and he was a major protagonist. So therefore, you know, my excuse is that I can't possibly hope to do justice to the man's legacy in half an hour. And I hope you'll excuse me for that. I'm just going to focus on a couple of points that I think are worthy of discussion.
We paid for the overnight rental in the hall. Carry on.
So I'd like to start off by posing a question. And the question is, what if there'd been no Mao Zedong? In what way would China, and indeed the world, have been different? How many people wouldn't have lived long, full and meaningful lives? How many people wouldn't have had enough to eat? How many people wouldn't have learned to read and write? How many people wouldn't have had access to education, to healthcare? How many people wouldn't have made it past the age of 35? Would China ever have broken out of that cycle of underdevelopment and intense poverty? Would the century of humiliation have turned into two centuries of humiliation? Would China even exist as a united country, or would it have been broken into pieces by rival imperialist powers? Would it be run by warlords, as Afghanistan still is today? Would China conceivably be the economic and scientific powerhouse that it is today? Would China, which before the revolution was one of the most impoverished and backward countries in the world, have a few days ago landed a rocket on the moon, becoming only the first country in history to do so? Would it be launching telecom satellites on behalf of Bolivia, which it did a few days ago, on behalf of Venezuela, on behalf of Ecuador? Would the socialist experiments in Latin America be receiving the funding they need to build their very exciting social programs? Would BRICS and these other formations be around to start challenging, albeit in a relatively roundabout way, US global hegemony? And to me, that's an interesting question. Because, of course, in the West, we generally hear it put in a very different way. You know, there was this monster of a man, Mao Zedong, and he was responsible for the deaths of millions and millions of people. You know, according to some really very well-paid historians, Mao was single-handedly responsible for what they tell us was the greatest famine, the biggest famine in human history. There may be hundreds of these well-paid, well-respected Western historians who are basically competing with each other to provide the biggest the most appalling, the most awe-inspiring number in their famous game, in their favourite game, how many deaths is Chairman Mao responsible for? You know, you can almost imagine after hours at the bar at SOAS playing Mao poker. It's like, oh, 50 million. Hmm. Well, I'll see your 50 million and I'll raise you another 10 million. Because that 60 million, that seems to have become the accepted figure in Western academia now for how many people died in the Great Leap Forward. For example, there's a popular book I was looking at called Mao's Great Famine by a guy called professor called Frank Decotta. It actually tries to seriously estimate that as many as 60 million people died during the four-year period of the Great Leap Forward, that is 1958 to 1961. And that's suddenly become an accepted figure. I mean, there's obviously not a great deal of evidence provided, but that's not really the point. I mean, you kind of had to ask, just on a basic logical level, how is that even possible? Was the Great Leap Forward some kind of mass extermination program that it was able to wipe out fully 10% of China's population at the time? You know, it's no problem, in spite of lack of evidence, for people like Decotta to get their books published, because their role isn't to provide evidence and meaningful historical analysis. Their role is to attack China. You know, we're supposed to ignore the fact that in spite of this incredible, unprecedented loss of human life, China's overall population didn't go down in that 5 years. In fact, it increased by 30 million. So in spite of the loss of 60 million, the overall population increased by 30 million. This is really relatively extraordinary. So, I mean, the Great Leap Forward was not some kind of crazed population control scheme. It was an ambitious program led by Mao to achieve rapid industrialization and collectivization, the idea being to create a much-needed break with underdevelopment and poverty. You know, creating a much-needed break with underdevelopment and poverty is a good cause. It means people living longer and better. And what is socialism about, if not that? Now, were there mistakes? Were there serious excesses? Did lots of people suffer terribly, some to the extent of starvation? Yes, that's true. Mao himself admitted to that. There were mistakes, and there was also a disastrous series of floods and a disastrous series of droughts. But one cannot go from that to talking about the greatest crime ever committed against humanity. You know, this wasn't the Nazi Holocaust. This wasn't the forced transportation of at least 100 million Africans as slaves to the Americas. This wasn't the brutal murder of 10 million Congolese by the armies of the Belgian King Leopold. This wasn't the killing of 35 million Chinese by the Japanese invading armies between 1937 and 1945. And nor was it the very deliberate policy-driven famines of our oh-so-civilized British colonialism in Ireland, in India, and elsewhere. So, I mean, you know, I'm not going to attempt to go into detailed refutations here of the sort of nonsense that people like Decotta come out with. And there's plenty of excellent material available on that if people are interested to look for it. But I think it is very important to defend China, to refute this slander, to refute this idea of Mao as a monster. Because the whole point of the Mao is a monster narrative is to denigrate China. What these people are trying to do, what their job is, fundamentally, is to prove the superiority of capitalism over socialism, is to prove the superiority of colonialism and imperialism over national self-determination and independence. You know, essentially, they're saying to the people, the masses of the world who've risen up, you were better off when we were in charge. But when we investigate the actual facts, as Mao would have us do, seek truth from facts, and we refute all this endless slander, we can, in fact, prove the direct opposite. We can prove the superiority of socialism over capitalism. We can prove the superiority of independence and national sovereignty over colonialism and over imperialism. What capitalist country has achieved so much in so short a time compared with what's been achieved in China and what was achieved in the Soviet Union. And furthermore, where capitalist countries have achieved a high level of development and have achieved, you know, a certain, you know, that stage of not being constantly at the mercy of natural disasters, having a certain amount of stability and security and whatever, what has been the cost of that, not only to the workers of their own country, but to the world? You know, what laid the basis for development in Europe and North America? Slavery, colonialism, and brutal class oppression. The perpetuation of a system of global apartheid that we're still struggling against today. So does anyone imagine that a British factory worker at the time of Industrial Revolution had some kind of wonderful life with delicious, nutritious food, excellent education, excellent healthcare, excellent social insurance, social security, and all the rest of it, and meanwhile lots of spare time learning to play violin, etc., etc.? Hardly. And even they were massively privileged compared to their counterparts who'd been taken from Africa to the Americas and to the Caribbean, or compared to their counterparts in India, China, Brazil, and elsewhere, whose lives were totally broken through plunder and colonial policy. So we have to emphasize that the progress that's been made in the socialist world is not rooted in slavery, is not rooted in colonialism, but is rooted in the hard-won efforts and determination of its own people. And that in itself proves the inherent superiority of socialism over capitalism. As an aside, since I've mentioned him a few times, I should point out that this Professor Dikota has a, you know, slightly patchy record as a historian. He's a vehement anti-communist. He, in fact, has gone on record arguing for the rehabilitation of the legacy of Chiang Kai-shek, yeah, never mind the millions he killed, as a great example of a modernizer and revolutionary. And the guy used his inaugural lecture at SOAS to argue that Britain's role pushing opium on the masses of the Chinese population in the mid-19th century really wasn't that bad of a thing. Go figure. So, you know, there's a bit of a gap in the market when it comes to modern Chinese history. Instead of how many people died because of Chairman Mao, why don't we ask how many people lived because of Chairman Mao? To attribute all unnatural deaths since 1949 to this one single human being, then surely by the same measure it's reasonable to attribute all life beyond whatever the life expectancy was in 1949 to this single human being. Because before the revolution, life expectancy in China was around 35 years, you know, really not all that long. China was ravaged by war, by famine, stagnation, feudalism, colonial brutality. By the time Mao died, 27 years later, in 1976, life expectancy had almost doubled. It was 67 years. Now it's 75. Not bad. The pre-revolution literacy rate in China was around 20%. By the time of Mao's death, it was 93%. Which is an incredible achievement. I don't know if there's that even has a comparison in history. And to give you a reasonable example, India, which got its liberation at about the same time and was in a very similar level of development, even now its literacy rate is only 74%. So to have gone so quickly to almost universal literacy is a remarkable achievement. China's population had been pretty steady, stagnated at around 500 million for approximately 100 years before the Chinese Revolution. By the time of Mao's death, that had risen to 700 million. So it had gone up from 500 million to 700 million. So clearly, something had changed for the better. Clearly, circumstances were more favourable for human life. Women who were ground down by millennia of feudal backwardness were able to make unprecedented gains towards attaining social equality. A thriving culture of literature, music, painting, theatre grew up and suddenly became accessible to the masses of the people. You know, even the sort of the endlessly ground down Chinese peasantry, which had never had access to these things, all of a sudden had access to these things. China, after a century of near total foreign domination, was able to maintain its sovereignty, develop industry, develop the means to defend itself militarily. It was able to help other nations. Less than a year after the proclamation of the People's Republic of China, it sent an enormous volunteer army, led by one of the great revolutionary heroes, Peng Dehui, to fight with the Koreans against the US. 180,000 Chinese soldiers were killed in that war. What an incredible sacrifice in the name of humanity. So, you know, the Mao era is perhaps not the nightmare it's sometimes painted as. You know, Mao was not a monster. He was one of the truly great revolutionary leaders of the 20th century. And it's correct that we recognize him. Talk of Mao's mistakes is, you know, that's fine. Yeah, that's important too. We can do that. You know, we probably disagree on what they were. People have had that discussion, and it goes on. But, you know, he was, after all, a human being, and by definition, made mistakes. Being the leading figure in a revolution that covers a quarter of the world's population, well, your mistakes have a certain significance that perhaps our mistakes don't, you know. As to your successes, I mean, I make mistakes all the time. Luckily, I wield neither power nor influence, and therefore it doesn't really matter. but, you know, regardless of mistakes, it's very clear that these were the mistakes of a great revolutionary, an exceptional leader who, more than any other single person, is responsible for Chinese liberation. So, slightly more sophisticated bourgeois analysts will tell you, okay, you know, you're right, some progress is made in China, has been made in China. It's a little bit better than it was before the revolution. But really, the progress has all been in the last 30 years, in the period after the introduction of, you know, some market reforms, in the period after the introduction of a certain level of foreign capital. And that seems to make them a bit happier, the idea that there's a little bit, you know, a little semblance of capitalism going on. They're more comfortable with that. They can accept that, it seems. And, you know, let's not be churlish. It's certainly true that incredible steps forward have been made in recent decades. But that progress is built on the basis of what came before it. The program of industrialization and collectivization of the 50s and 60s and 70s in the first three decades of People's China. I wonder what sort of situation the rest of the world would be in now. You know, in what way it would be different if it hadn't been for Mao, if it hadn't been for the Chinese Revolution. I put it to you that it would probably be a very different place. And at least for the masses of Asia, Africa, Latin America and the Caribbean, it would be a much less hopeful place. Now, historically, of course, there is the very active, practical, tangible support for the liberation struggles in Zimbabwe, in Algeria, in Korea, in Tanzania, in Zambia, in Mozambique and elsewhere. But also, it's important to note, as I think Hopal did earlier, the Chinese revolutionary model, the means by which it attained its liberation, was particularly relevant and particularly inspirational to the many countries that were, similarly to China, locked in colonial subjugation and underdevelopment. These ideas, you know, of people's war, of revolutionary base areas, of building a peasant army, these concepts resonated across the Third World. And I think it's fair to say that maybe perhaps more than anyone, it was Mao and the Chinese Revolution that really helped to spread and expand the scope of Marxism from the industrial working class of Europe to the oppressed masses worldwide. And today, today, those countries of the global south that are working hard to improve the lives of their populations are deeply appreciative of the support they get from China. You know, Venezuela's rise over the last 14 years after Hugo Chavez came to power would have been extremely difficult without China's support. Chinese support is crucial to Cuba, to South Africa, to Bolivia, to Ecuador, Zimbabwe, Nicaragua, and lots of other places. in a very kind of slow, gradual, roundabout sort of way, there seems like there's an opening for this stranglehold of Western imperialism, especially US imperialism, to be broken. And it seems to me very unlikely that that opening would be there had it not been for the Chinese Revolution, had it not been for the courage, the brilliance and the incredible inventiveness of Mao Zedong and his comrades. Another great revolutionary, Nelson Mandela, who, as you know, sadly died a couple of weeks ago, wrote in his autobiography about what had inspired him and the sort of discussions they were having, the sort of study they were doing when the ANC and the SACP and Umkhonto's Wesizwe were working out their strategy in the late 50s and early 60s. And he says, "I read the works by and about Che Guevara, Mao Zedong, and Fidel Castro." He says, "In Edgar Snow's brilliant Red Star Over China, I saw that it was Mao's determination and non-traditional thinking that led him to victory." That's an interesting phrase to use. But I think this idea of non-traditional thinking is a very important aspect of Mao's legacy. And, maybe it's unfair to say it, but I find it ironic that quite a few of the Maoists you meet these days, especially in the west of the world, are not so much with the non-traditional thinking. No. Frankly, a lot of them are painfully dogmatic and seem to think that Mao's works provide some sort of blueprint for revolution, when in fact Mao was totally against the idea of books as blueprints, or indeed any type of blueprints. His writings and speeches constantly called for creative and serious analysis of specific problems rather than the application of formulas. He was actually pretty harsh about it. He's got a very enjoyable pamphlet called Opposed Book Worship. I'm going to read you a short quote for it. He says, "Unless you have investigated a problem, then you will be deprived of the right to speak on it." Isn't that too harsh? Not in the least. When you have not probed into a problem, into the present facts and its past history, and you know nothing of its essentials, whatever you say about it will undoubtedly be nonsense. Talking nonsense solves no problems, as everybody knows. So why is it unjust to deprive you of the right to speak? Quite a few comrades always keep their eyes shut and talk nonsense, and for a communist, that's disgraceful. Of course we should study Marxist books, but this study must be integrated with our country's actual conditions. We need books, but we must overcome book worship. So today, to follow the example of Mao is not to do everything that Mao did. It's not to treat Mao's strategy as the one strategy to rule them all. It's not to go to the hills and set up revolutionary base areas. Rather, it is...
In Guildford.
Especially not in Guildford. It's rubbish. Rather, it is to try and emulate Mao's bravery, his creativity, his understanding, his never-ending dedication to the masses of the Chinese people, in particular the working class and the peasantry, and to celebrate his legacy, to celebrate his contribution to China, his contribution to the world. Thank you.
Carlos, thinking untraditionally, I couldn't have done a better job myself. That's good. Thank you so much. That was a very, very inspiring speech, and a lot covered in a very short period of time. You must come again.
FRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, 250 watts of community power.
For your own pleasure, a well-hidden treasure, Pizza Trocadero. We serve delicious gourmet pizza with daily made dough, homemade sauce.